Hello, everyone, and welcome to The Hidden Lives of Writers. My name's Fiona Snickers, and I'm joined by my co-host, Gail Schimmel. Hi, Gail.
Hi, Fiona, and hello to everyone listening.
Gail, let's jump right in. What kind of a writing week have you had?
It's been very exciting. In fact, I can't even talk about my writing week. It's about my writing month, because I have been in a new book for the last while, and it's been so exciting. I've been writing with that passion, with that enjoyment of a story that's exciting me, and I've been using a technique that you talked about. Time has no meaning for me anymore. I don't even know how long ago it was. But you talked about the idea of flashlighting or headlighting. The idea of knowing where you start, knowing where you end, and then also knowing the next little bit of your path. And I've been writing down kind of three chapters ahead, a few words just about where each chapter is going to go. And I have found it such a good way to write, because you sit down and you know exactly what you have to do that day. And then when I see it running out, I have a little think session. I think about where the next few chapters have to go. I headlight them. I write down where I'm going. And it has made the writing process so easy, so enjoyable. So I'm feeling like a really efficient writer at the moment. What about you?
You know, my writing week has been boring, and that is not necessarily a bad thing. I'm just realizing that I've been plugging away every day. I'm working on two books at the moment, and each morning I sit down with my fresh brain and I add about 400 words to each manuscript, and I might add a bit more in the afternoon. And it's not exciting. I'm not in a surge of great creativity or great productivity at the moment. But each manuscript is growing incrementally day by day. It's getting bigger and bigger. And in a few months, those books will be done. They'll be complete. And I think I will be reasonably happy with them. So if I had to draw an analogy, I guess it's like fitness or something you're trying to achieve in your life, where it's not always in great leaps and bounds. Sometimes it's just in taking a few steps forward each day, and that can be fine.
And I think it's that quite exciting truth that if you write regularly every day and you write a little chunk every day, it's actually amazing how quickly a book can come out of that process.
Yeah, every now and again, because I'm not really paying much attention to my running word count, but every now and again I look down and I'm 20,000 words ahead of the last time I looked down. I'm like, ooh, how did that happen, you know? And then it feels more like a big stride rather than little tiny shuffling footsteps.
So maybe the advice of the day should be, don't look at your word count too often. Although then how do you know what you've done for the day? So that's a difficult one. I'll have to think about that.
Gail, what have you been reading or watching or listening to lately?
Okay, so I've got a lot to talk about. So I'll try and talk quickly. First of all, there's a book I'm not reading at the moment. It's a book by a very well-known South African writer, Fiona Snickers.
Oh, goodness.
Called The Hidden. I'm lucky enough to have an advanced copy of it. But Fiona, I love your writing so much that I'm keeping it like a little diamond of happiness that I know will be waiting for me when I really need it. But it's almost turning into madness that I'm like, no, you must keep this for when you really, really need a book that you can rely on. So I touch it and I pick it up and then I put it down and go, no, you don't need it now. I think I'm saving it to read in my holidays. I think I love reading your work when I'm on holiday, so I think I'm saving it for that. Then I read Yellow Face because you told me to.
Ah, yes.
I did love it. I did find it very interesting, but I don't think I'm going to bore our listeners with more Yellow Face. I think we've Yellow Faced ourselves.
We've covered it. Definitely one of my books of the year, I must say.
You know what? It's difficult for me to know how I would have come to that book if you hadn't primed me for it so much. And yes, definitely. It's fascinating. And as a writer, it's almost a must read. You know, there's so much in it that is so interesting and makes you think. And gosh, she's frustrating. But I will talk to you about that off air. But everyone must, writers must read it, I think, is actually my take out of that. Then I am reading Year of the Locust by Terry Hayes. It is the much awaited second book from the writer of I Am Pilgrim. Like I Am Pilgrim, you started thinking, this is quite complex. Am I going to be able to follow? There's 70 million kajillion pages to go, and I'm already a bit confused. And then suddenly you're deep in the world and you're gripped, and that's where I am at the moment. It has also reminded me with I Am Pilgrim, I had a slight discomfort that there is a undertone of Islamophobia simply because of the world it is set in.
Mm-hmm.
And with this one, I'm feeling it again. Oh, maybe dear. Worrying about it a bit more because of what is going on in the world as I read. And
yes.
This is not a time to be encouraging any type of Islamophobia, anti-Semitism, either side of the coin. You know, we need to be fighting that in ourselves. So I have a slight discomfort, but God, I'm gripped. So discomfort or not, I'm reading that book and I can't wait to get back to my book. And then finally,
mm-hmm.
I have joined the ranks of people who know how to watch TV that is not generally available because I asked my teenage child. And I'm watching The Great British Bake Off.
Okay.
And it makes me so happy. I watch it and I just, everything's right with the world and I love it and I'm so happy. And I really have decided that it's the secret to happiness, The Great British Bake Off. What about you, Fiona?
Well, I've just read a book that really kind of woke me up and made me sit up and think. And again, it was on a recommendation from you. It's Cleopatra and Frankenstein by Chloe Mellers. And it's one of the BookTok sensations of 2023. It really made a big splash. And I think from that and from the cover, I was expecting something a lot lighter.
Mm.
And it really is not light. It's
really
an extremely
not.
Hectic book. I think set in the 1990s in the world of advertising, New York City advertising, when everyone was doing cocaine like an absolute maniac, apparently, and having the craziest sex I've ever heard about. And it really is like having a bucket of ice water chucked over your head. It is shocking. It makes you think. And then it kind of devolves into something a lot gentler and a lot deeper and more rooted in people's relationships and who is really compatible with whom in a way that made me think. Mm. But because it's a debut, it's so startlingly original.
Mm.
I would advise people to read it, to put aside their discomfort with the first part of the book and just allow it to take you into some very unexpected places. Mm.
And I think don't be put off by the TikTok sensation aspect, because it's not a book you would expect to be a TikTok sensation.
No, not at all.
It's not like a lot of the others, without being judgy about the others, but a lot of them I don't enjoy.
Yeah.
And this, it's a book of substance.
It's a book of literary fiction. It really is. I'm surprised that it did so well on BookTok. But I'm letting some judgment leak through here. But anyway, moving on. Our guest today is somebody who's books are more like a warm hug, a cup of hot chocolate, a Chelsea bun, rather than a bucket of ice water over the head. And I'm sure everyone's going to enjoy her. Our guest today is Carnita Loxton. Carnita is the author of the Being series, including Being Carrie, Being Lily, Being Shelley, and Being Diane. Carnita is also the winner of the Phillida Literary Award for her body of work and her contribution to literature. Hi, Carnita, and welcome. We are so excited to have you as our first ever remote guest from Cape Town.
Well, I am very excited because I think I'm the number one fan of this podcast. So I'm out of my skin with excitement to be here, but also quite scared that I'm going to say something stupid after all the exciting guests you've had before me.
Well, I'm just excited because seeing Carnita is always one of my favorite things. So even though it's only on a screen, I'm also a little bit beside myself this morning, Fiona. So you're going to have to rein me in if I start smiling at Carnita and touching the screen in a loving way.
We're going to get on to women's friendships and working with your women friends and all this kind of thing. But in the meantime, Carnita, how has your writing week been?
So now this is the one question that probably kept me up most of the week in preparation for this podcast. And I've decided to just be honest and say that I've only written WhatsApps this entire week. Nothing else has come. But my WhatsApps, I think, have been brilliant. They've made Gail laugh from time to time. So I think it's a success.
Okay, awesome.
I can vouch for that. Lots of excellent writing happening. And also, Carnita, you're in that awkward stage for a writer where you've finished a piece of work and the next one hasn't really come to you. It's a funny stage. Yes,
it is, because I submitted a manuscript probably about 3 weeks ago. And since then, I felt a little bit depleted in a way, like I'm not ready to just jump into something new. And I know there's this thing that you shouldn't wait for the muse to descend and you should just write the words and all of that. But I do feel a bit empty, you know, sort of lost without the previous story, but not yet hooked into the next one.
Mm. I think it's a very real thing. I think giving yourself a break is allowed. We will allow it for a short time. But don't get carried away.
Okay, thank you.
Carnita, I want to hear, and I've really been looking forward to asking you this because I know bits and pieces, but I don't know the whole story. We want your origin story. I know that you are, like me, a recovering lawyer, but I want to know how you came from being a lawyer to being a writer and even why you became a lawyer in the first place.
I'm a fully recovered lawyer, so I have no desire to look at any contract ever again for the rest of my life. But studying law and getting to law was quite a happy story. I didn't have the intention to always do law, you know, to set the world to rights and fight for justice and all of that. It was as basic as being in matric and having to fill out the application form and being a first generation sort of university student, I couldn't just put BA on the application form. So it had to be BA law. And luckily for me, all the courses in first year were courses that I liked. It was languages and sociology and sort of those kind of things that if you weren't doing law with it, you wouldn't be able to do anything with it. But I really enjoyed the study of law. I enjoyed articles. I enjoyed working. I worked in a corporate for years after that, and I enjoyed the whole thing of it. And I thought I was going to be like Gail, be superwoman and do everything and have the children and do the job and all of that. But we struggled to fall pregnant and have a baby and all of that. And when the child came, it was such a shock to my system that I realized that I actually couldn't and didn't want to do it all. And so I worked as a freelancer for a while. And when that became too deathly boring, I looked for something else to do. And I started a coaching practice for a while, sort of within the business area that I'd been working in. And that was quite fun. But I realized now with hindsight that the best part of it was listening to everybody's stories, because everybody comes to a coaching process with their story and their background and what they want to achieve in their career. But it's never separate from their lives. And so listening to stories, I guess, being part of people's stories has always been something that's appealed to me. And so when I was, I think, 38, 39, I probably had a bit of a midlife crisis about doing something interesting that wasn't just sort of a little bit of law on the side. And I came to a writing course that was run by Mike Nichol, and I started that. But it was with a sense of disbelief, you know, writing a novel, never been on my radar, sort of something that other people did. And so with him, I learned that I had the capacity to write more than 500 words, and 500 words became a manuscript. And then I got lucky with a publication. And so it's been, you know, probably 10 years of a lot of luck in the publishing world.
A lot of luck and a lot origin. Of talent.
Yes. And Carnita, when you are in the throes of writing a novel, what does your writing week look like then? Just take us through your daily process, different stages of the novel. How does that work out for you?
Well, I do spend a lot of time thinking about it, in the sense that it's got to be an idea that isn't only interesting to me for a week. Mm-hmm. And once I know that it's got its hooks in my brain and that I can't think about anything else, then I know this is a story I can spend a year on. I do quite boringly probably spend a little bit of time with a calendar. I like to plan how long, over what period of time the story is going to be, and, you know, more, because it gives me a sense of how action must be, like at what, you know, how many days is this going to take up. What's going to happen in the next week? Can nothing happen for 3 weeks, kind of thing? So I think about that, but it's like a security blanket, because not all of that makes it into the story, but it makes me feel strong enough to start writing, that I feel like I've got somewhere to go. And then when I am writing, I'm quite disciplined about it, so I will write every day. I do have to trick myself into writing for that day, so I put a timer on my phone. It's for an hour at a time. I don't write any WhatsApps. I don't Google anything. I don't, you know, unless something's burning somewhere, I don't leave my desk for that hour. I'm there. And that works, because otherwise I get distracted. And so in the time that I'm writing, I'm very disciplined about it. And it's usually, I try to end that hour sort of mid paragraph or mid sentence or mid thought, so that I've got somewhere to go on the next day. And I think I'm quite hard on myself during the process. So there's always a bit of editing of what happened the day before I can just go on and write something new. So I think by the end of the manuscript, it's never just like some writers say, everything just gets downloaded from their brain into the screen and it's a mad rush of writing. I'm probably a bit more considered, is a polite word. Anal is a not so nice word, but it can be painful at times.
Gail, isn't that interesting? We've talked before about how a problem that writers have, and I think we both have this problem, is that we don't have a sense in advance over what time period is this taking place in? What season is it taking place in? What time of day is it? You know, is it a 3-week novel or yeah. a 3-month novel or a 3-year novel? And Carnita, I've noticed in your whole series that there is a sense of the passage of time inside each book and also between each book. We know how much time has passed between each book. And that gives it to, it just makes it so much more real. Mm. Don't you think?
And I think it's something so many people struggle with, that timing. I listened to a podcast with Jodie Picoult the other day, and she said the thing she always gets in trouble with when she's edited is that her timeline is always off. Well, she should speak to Carnita, because yes. Carnita knows how to fix that.
Yes, start off with the calendar. That's amazing.
Yeah, Carnita. It makes me feel a bit safer about where to go, because I get quite overwhelmed with thinking about this, all these pages to fill and the story mm-hmm. to write. And so that gives me a little feeling of control, even though it's not real.
Well, I think it could be very real. I'm fascinated. I hope my brain can move on from the calendar. Because I've got lots and lots of questions about writing a series. And the first is, when you started with Carrie, did you know you were going to be writing a series, or were you just writing Carrie as a once-off?
I didn't think about writing a series. I think if I'd anticipated that it would be a series, I would have changed some things in some of the characters. But the friends were very much built around Carrie as the protagonist. And I think it happens because it was so first person. Everything revolves around that character. But what happened, and that I hadn't anticipated happening, was that I felt like I got to know the other characters so well that they developed stories of their own, and that I hadn't anticipated. So it wasn't the intention from the start, but definitely by the end of Carrie, I had a sense that Lily's story was so real to me that I could tell that story separately. And that was quite fun and a surprise also to me.
And then, having made this decision that now you are going to write it as a series, how do you protect yourself so from saying in Lily, putting a fact about Shelley that is now going to limit you in Shelley's story? How do you manage that whole process that you know you're going to be telling all the stories, but you don't necessarily yet know what their stories exactly are?
Well, that's actually for me a big part of the fun of it, because it seemed to me that that's how life is, right? You've built on the next story with a set of limitations that you have from what you've created previously. And so I didn't think about what was coming next. I just wrote what was right for that character and for that story. And so for the next one, it had to fit in there. So there was no forethought about, I'm putting this little secret here that comes out later on. And that felt to me to be authentic in how people's lives fit together. You don't have control over what's happened before. You just make the best of it and see where it takes you. So that was quite a fun part, but I did have to sometimes go back to the previous books and say, oh, well, what's happened there? And just to remind myself.
And the last question on this, you're saying that it was fun, but were there not moments where you're like, what the hell was I thinking? How could I have done this when now I want to do another thing? Or did it just work?
I really loved that part of it because it sort of hones your creativity in a way. Even though it's a limitation, it gives you something to almost grapple with, you know, like you have to mold it around something that's pre-existing. You don't just have complete free range. So it tested my creativity.
And speaking of authenticity, I don't know if you guys know the story. Marion Keyes, who you've both got a connection to, Marion Keyes once in an interview said that for her, reading the books of Maeve Binchy was like a revelation from the heavens because it was the first time she realized that as a writer, you can write in the sort of Irish English dialect. You can write the way people speak, the way people on the streets of Dublin speak, and you can have a book like that and it's fine. And that gave her the freedom to give a voice to her own characters. And we all know how charming Marion Keyes' voice is and the voices of her characters. And I find that very much with your books, Carnita. You write the way South Africans speak and your characters all have this individualized voice. And how do you tap into that voice? Was Carrie in any way your voice or a familiar voice to you? Or did you feel close to one of the other characters? How do you get that tone and voice right?
I think I've always been a natural observer. So I'm not somebody that is the life of the party. I'm not always the person telling the stories in a conversation. And I think that is partly my personality, partly also just growing up in a family where maybe verbally things weren't always expressed explicitly. So you tuned into how people behave and what they say and what their faces look like and what they don't say. So I think that's just naturally who I am, is that I am very aware of people. And so I think that comes out in the way that I write, because I see people. I really enjoy being around different kinds of people. And so I think that, I don't actually know where it comes from. And as for Carrie and her voice, she's probably the least like me of all of the characters. But I think because of, you know, the story that's in it, people often think that it's the most like me. So that's quite fun, always saying, no, but I'm not Carrie.
But the Carrie does feel more autobiographical in that her, yes, her background is more like yours. So in what ways, yes, is it autobiographical? In what ways is she completely different?
Well, it's autobiographical in the sense that she is married to an Afrikaans man, and I am from a Muslim family also. So that at the core of it is the similarity. But in terms of her indecisiveness, she drives me completely insane. She's for a lot of the time, she seems to sort of float through the story without wanting to make a decision and waiting to see which way the tide is going to push her. And that's not how I experience myself. Once I've made up my mind, I'm doing something. So it's always quite fun to see people put me and Carrie so closely together. But, you know, I'm not unique in that way. Most people's first novels have a lot of themselves hidden in it.
And which character, in terms of their personality and their way of dealing with life, which one do you feel closest to?
They all have aspects of me, but I think I'm probably closer to Lily, which is interesting because most people don't really like Lily as a character. I think she's quite forceful, and she can be quite bossy. You know, my children often say to me in a very impolite way that I can be relentless, and I think that is, you know, I think if I want to do something, nothing will stop me from doing it. And so I think that's one of the things that I like about Lily, is that she pushes on. And you know, I hope that's a quality that I have in a positive way.
And with the characters, you've gone through quite a scope of, you know, different types of people and putting yourself in the heads of different people from different cultures and different races. How difficult was that?
I was very careful about that. So in Shelley, for example, she's married to a Jewish man. And she grapples with not having converted to Judaism and her husband's, sort of desire to rekindle that part of himself. And in Diane's example, she's a bisexual woman. She has a relationship with a woman and with a man. Lily is a aesthetic, practitioner. So she's Botoxing and fillering and doing all of that kind of thing. And I spend a lot of time for all four characters in interviewing people who had similar backgrounds, who had similar jobs. Some of them were friends who were happy to talk to me for an hour or two, and some people were strangers. And it was to understand, it's not that you can interview one person and know, sort of generalize what it would mean to be, for example, a bisexual woman. But it gave me insight that I wouldn't have for myself or just for Googling, and also to understand the reasonableness of, well, I don't know if reasonableness is the right word, but the possibilities that of the feelings and emotions that those characters would have. So it was an interesting process to go through to interview real life people to get sort of a background for the characters.
And have you had any comeback on any of them? Anyone going, no, that's not how a person like that would feel. That's not how a bisexual woman would behave. Or
I haven't got any to my face. So you don't know how it goes in the discussions. Everybody's been very polite about it. But it is something I'm very careful about. But at the end of it, I think emotions are emotions, you know.
Now let's talk about the lockdown years, because I'm always interested in what writers were doing during those years. And I think you had quite a busy lockdown by the sounds of it. Being Diane was written during that period, am I right?
Yes.
And also your co-writing project, Chasing Marion. Can you break that down for us? Like, how was it when lockdown was declared? How did you deal with it? And how did you get into writing then?
Well, we obviously had the kids because we've got school-age boys, so we did a lot of homeschooling. And when I say we, I mean my husband, Edgar, who is an excellent tutor. It's one of his many skills. But we had a long kitchen table, and we all set up our computer stations at the table. So, you know, we all sort of sit there typing away kind of thing. Trying to pretend that it's not locked down and that there's not a banana bread baking in the oven kind of thing. But so I wrote Diane very early in the morning at sort of 5 to 6, half past 4 to 6 o'clock in the morning, because it gave me a feeling of control over the day and a place to escape to that wasn't locked down and it wasn't children, all of that. Chasing Marion was sort of written at the table with everybody else. And that was great because that was also, it felt like a project that I could do with everybody around me. I didn't feel like it was that intense a thing that I needed complete quiet. It was mostly banana bread and writing for lockdown.
And did you, when you were writing Chasing Marion, did you have the sense that this is a proper novel and it's going to go somewhere and be a success? Or was it just something you were doing for fun with your friends?
No, I had no idea that it would go anywhere. I didn't think about it as a book. I thought of it as...
You thought about it as a terrible deadline that you had to meet when it was your week.
Yeah.
And we'd get stressed messages from Carnita towards the end of the week going, I haven't done my chapter yet. I haven't done my chapter yet.
Yeah. So the writing felt stressful because I didn't have that calendar. So I didn't have a sense of security about where I thought I was going. And I didn't know what Pam was going to do or what Amy was going to do, it was Gail was going to do. And so when it came, it tested me creatively because, you know, I've got to make things work. And also I'm a little bit of a control freak and how am I going to get it back to where I think it wants to be? But I didn't think about it as a novel at all. For me, it was just a fantastic way to connect with people that I admire and enjoy and a way to do something that wasn't even remotely connected to COVID. So it really was a very special time in that sense.
Well, it's a very special book that came out of it. I love it.
We'll just smile happily and take the praise. I'm just trying to choose between my next two questions. Like, I'll ask the hard one, the serious one first. You are a woman of color. You come from a Muslim background, but you write quite light and easy novels. Do you ever feel a burden that you should be writing the great South African novel? Because you do come from quite a marginalized community that possibly has the softest voice in South Africa. Do you ever feel a burden from that?
It's a question that I've been asked a few times before. Probably the first time jarred me the most because it was on live radio and the interviewer said to me, as a woman of color, do you not feel a responsibility to write about more important things? And it's also a question that I've got in much smaller settings. Most recently at a library function where the woman said to me, as a woman of color, should you not be writing about abuse or poverty or things like that that really matter? So it's not something that I thought about when I started writing, because I didn't intend to write a novel. I was writing purely for my own entertainment and joy. And I write what brings me joy. And so I guess the answer to that is that the other stuff doesn't bring me joy to write
strangely.
But I think South African literature has moved to a point where you can and you should be able to write about anything. And if you're writing for fun's sake, you know, there should be a place for that also. Mm-hmm. And so my answer is also, I can't remember what my exact answer on the radio interview was. I might have hummed and, you know, deflected because I was so maybe naively shocked by it. But where I am now is that there are a range of readers in the same way that there are a range of writers, and there is enough space for everyone. And there isn't only one version of a woman of color. She doesn't always have to have been the poor, abused woman who lives in a terrible kind of environment. I think there's room to portray all kinds of characters, and to just write one particular viewpoint is a disservice. Mm-hmm. So I think there's space for all of it. I don't think one is better than the other.
I'm actually coming to believe that in this very difficult world that we live in, that the writing of light escapist literature, and I know some people will say that's an oxymoron, but I don't think so, the writing of light escapist books is actually quite an important service. I'm coming to believe more and more people need to escape, and writers who give them that chance are doing something very important.
But I also think that when people say you've written something light, or if it's a light book, it seems to imply that you're not writing something that's important. Mm. And for me, that's a very important distinction, because my books are, in quotes, easy to read. And often when you say that, people think, oh, well, it's fluffy and it's meaningless. But in my books, I like to believe that there is social commentary that will make you think beyond just what that book is about. And so, you know, for Carrie, there's an interracial marriage. There is talk of a marginalized community. In Lily, it's this whole idea of privilege and what you see versus what happens in, you know, in that woman's head. Also, you know, getting married to a younger man, all of those kind of things. Shelley deals with a woman's midlife crisis where she essentially touches on the fringe of sexually harassing a much younger employee. Diane is about you know, learning to deal with your teenage daughter's sexuality, essentially. So these are books that are easy to read, but I don't think that saying something's easy to read or light implies that it's meaningless and that it's got nothing to say.
Excellent answer. I love that.
I love it too. And, you know, sometimes all one needs is a bit of distance to realize in hindsight how important a book actually was. Mm. I mean, in the 19th century, Dickens and Austen were the sort of chick lit and the Netflix of their days. And now they are taken seriously and studied. And I think that when we have a bit of distance from our time now, books like the Being series, which really showed snippets of life the way it is lived by many women, will be regarded as much more important than they perhaps are recognized as being now.
I think Anita's definitely the Austen of South Africa for the future.
I'm going to put that on a quote somewhere on cards and give it out to people.
One of the serious issues that I think you do touch on is women's friendships, these WhatsApp groups. Like, the whole series is premised on the idea of these women are in a WhatsApp group together, and then, you know, another member gets added later on. And they also start the HELP, the help WhatsApp group. You know, when somebody's in crisis and really needs advice pronto, they can put something on that WhatsApp group. And then we also have Shelley and Diane working together in a shop, and things aren't always going swimmingly for them. You know, there's a bit of tension, there's a bit of conflict. So are women's friendships important to you in your life? And was it important to you to sort of represent it on the page?
Women have always been important in my life from the start, before there were WhatsApps. And that has been both in my family structure and as friends. I was never really part of a big friend group going through high school. You know, there were maybe one or two friends. But most definitely as an adult woman, I've come to appreciate the value that women's friendship bring to me. And so for me, that's something uplifting, something that brings me joy, and that falls into my writing, because that's where the writing goes for me also. It's something that brings me happiness. So I think it's almost inevitable that the two will link up. But the WhatsApp groups right now are a very real part of my life. You know, there's a writer's help group that doesn't only deal with writing. There's a group that's just all of kids stuff. And so I think the women friendships for me is something that's a very important, a sustaining part of my life. It would be very lonely without it.
I think your slip there was quite an interesting one, because I think writers' friendships are also quite important for a writer. Would you agree?
Yes. I mean, I think writing is a very lonely thing. And it's, for me, I don't think I'm any different from anyone else, but it's full of self-doubt, full of self-criticism. It's full of, am I doing the right thing? Should I even be doing this anyway? And why am I doing it? And then somebody, I won't mention any names, but, you know, might be part of the podcast, says, oh, pull yourself together and go and write 500 words. And then you don't always write the 500 words, but you think, yeah, okay, I could be doing that.
What do you mean you don't always write the 500 words? You always report back that you've done it.
Oh, okay. Maybe we should edit that part out.
And women in the aging process, it comes in most in, I think, Being Lily, the pressure on women to appear younger, to be younger, to just present themselves to the world as eternally youthful. Is that a pressure you felt yourself, and why did you want to put that into your fiction?
I think it's inescapable. I think when you are women of a certain age, which is where I find myself and all my friends, it is something that everybody suddenly seems to be talking about. I mean, I don't think I've heard more conversations about skin and weight and hair and since I was probably 14. Mm-hmm. All of a sudden, everybody seems to be very aware of it. And so I don't think you can write about women without acknowledging that aging process and the shock and horror and all of those things that go with it. And, you know, I'm just an ordinary woman in that sense. I'm not immune to any of it. I mean, I think I'm quite glad that we're doing it. A podcast where there's no video so that I didn't have to fix my hair before we got
Should
on.
Should we mention we're going to take a photograph of the screen?
Yes, I did see that afterwards, but you know, I'll try and see the light if I've got a ring light here somewhere.
We're actually sitting with a ring light on us because the sight okay. of my face when we sat down before was too much for me.
Yeah, but I think for me, I've definitely got healthier and stronger as I've got older. And so I've got a lot more appreciation for my body and for what it can do than it was in my 20-year-old self. So it's kind of a balance between going like, oh, look what's happening. Things are not working exactly as I wanted them to, or as everybody hopes they will still look. But I've got a lot of appreciation for this body and what it's done and done all of the IVFs and all of those kind of things and got me here still doing what I can do.
And it still runs and it still surfs.
Well, it doesn't run that much anymore. And the surfing, I've become a bit of a scaredy cat, but there's lots of other stuff that keeps me happy.
I'm too scared to ask.
Well, I don't know if you've seen, but there's I live on a golf course and I've been playing quite a lot of golf. But in the last week, the cobras have come out and they're all these videos doing the rounds about cobras and mongoose attacking each other. And so it feels like that's an adrenaline sport that I hadn't anticipated would be an adrenaline sport. So yeah, so maybe I shouldn't talk about that at all.
Goodness, I'm certainly rather glad that we live in Joburg.
Yeah, and not on a golf estate.
Well, I don't think cobras are much of an issue on golf courses in Johannesburg, but Cape Town
it's
a wild
been doing
place.
It
Carnita, getting back to the Being series as a series, I found that each one can be read as a standalone. It's like it's a complete narrative on its own. But there is also a sense of time progressing and the people's lives have progressed. So did your publishers want you to think about that? In other words, if somebody jumps into the series, say with Shelley, and you want them to go back and read the first two, you don't want to give too many spoilers for the first two books because you want people still to feel the desire to go back and read them. So was that a bit of a balancing act?
You know, it wasn't as much of a balancing act as maybe it sounds like it should be, because for me, the experience of each of these characters was very separate. And in a sense, I think that's how we are as people. So you can be four very close friends, and there can be a lot of overlap in your lives, but we all live completely independently in our heads. And those other three people, no matter how close they are to you, still actually can't really know what's all going on in your head. And that's the feeling that I wanted and why it's a big part of why I write in first person. So I feel like I'm completely living that person's life. So even though you're really close with somebody else, there's just still so much that they can't know about you. And so for me, it's also, even though you're really close and you think you're really tight friends with someone, there's the essential unknowableness of somebody else. And I wanted that. And I also wanted to have this idea that what you see of someone, no matter how close you are, doesn't necessarily mean that you know them. Mm-hmm. So it wasn't that hard a balancing act, really. I mean, I guess I was conscious of not sort of having too many spoilers about, you know, what was going on in the other stories. But I think the way that I wrote it in first person helped me, you know, sort of keep each one's story to themselves.
I don't know if you've noticed, we're making notes as you speak. What you've spoken, you've just said that we don't know everything about our friends. And one of the things, I know you've just written another book, but I have no idea. Have you stayed in the World of the Being series or have you moved into a new world? And how difficult?
It's not the Being series at all. And I think that's why it took me a little while to get going, because it was the creation of a whole new world. And this story is about a woman called June who lives in Cape Town in suburbia. And it's post-COVID, and she does what I think many women wanted to do or thought about doing, is that she just ups and goes on holiday and leaves her husband and her family at home. And she doesn't, I can't say it out now.
I can't say, but...
It's essentially that. It's a woman in her sort of middle career who just thinks post-COVID, is this it? Is this all that I'm doing? I can't do this for the next 30 years of my life. And my husband is still on the couch and I really don't want that. So I'm going.
That sounds delicious and very relatable.
Speaking of relatable, you have populated your world in the Being series with friends and family and this whole kind of community of people. Have you ever put your own friends and family into books, and have they ever recognized themselves, or have people ever thought they've recognized themselves?
I haven't put anyone specific in, but I guess all characters are an amalgamation of the people that you know or that you come across. And nobody's asked me. My mother, though, my mother died probably 2 months before Being Carrie was, 3 months before Being Carrie was published. And all she wanted to know was am I in the book? Am I there? And I could say to her, no, that you're not in there. So she never read it. So she could never say to me, well, I think that was me. But that's the closest that I've come to it. So I tend to use characters that I spy in a coffee shop or paying the parking ticket, or, you know, look at that woman and I think that's what you look like, but I wonder what's your whole story behind, and a character can come from that rather than somebody that I know.
I find I sometimes get a bit confused because I've made up a story about somebody that I've seen and then I forget whether that's a story I've heard and it's true, or whether it's something I've made up. Have you ever had that problem, or is this my problem?
No, there had been one or two scenes that I've stolen from friends where it's actually happened, but I've told them about it and they laughed and they think that it's fun, because it's never like completely unflattering. Because I've got a friend who I'm very close to, and during sort of peak homeschooling season, she sort of mid-morning had a shot of sherry or something in the pantry while her kids were studying. I mean, we laughed ourselves to death about that.
Every morning? That made,
no, just the one morning. When we all crashed ourselves laughing about that, because it's not something that would be usual. And that made it into my book. I think Sherry did it or something. And so that's like quite a fun thing. Yeah, I'm not one to sort of be vindictive and kill my people that I don't like in real life in my books.
I'm going down quite a different path now. I know that you are passionate about libraries. Do you want to talk a bit about where that comes from and your feelings about libraries?
I grew up in town, and so the Central Library on the Parade was where we went. My mother wasn't a big reader, and neither was my father really, but my mother made sure that we went to the library every Saturday, got the books. And so it was very much part of our childhood. And, you know, as a child, I wasn't the most outgoing. I didn't have the most friends, but, you know, the friends are always in books, and it, transports you. So that whole association with libraries is very much a part of my childhood. And then also high school, it was a time before Google. So the Central Library in Cape Town was a place where I spent a lot of hours doing research and all of that. So it made an impact on me in my formative years. And then I guess as a writer, the very first event that I went to was, I think it's called LIASA, which is the Librarians Association or something. And Mervyn Sloman of Book Lounge, he did an interview with me, and it was my very first time that I spoke in a sort of public space about being Carrie. I think there were probably 500 people. I don't know. I'm not good at judging the size of a crowd, but there were a lot of people, and they were all librarians, and they were so enthusiastic and passionate and receptive and energized about books that it made such an impression on me as an adult just to see what these people that I'd seen as a child just sort of sitting behind the desk do. And it gave me a completely different perspective into that whole sort of quiet space. And during my time now as a writer, every time I go into the library, it's not about sales or what you can push or having people enthusiastic enough to shell out their money to buy books. And I love the idea that my books are going to be in a library and that somebody will chance buy them with no other motivation except for the pleasure of reading it. I like that idea of the longevity of it in a library. So it's definitely the people and the space that calls me every time. I think it's also I do these sort of book club meetings in the libraries, and the people that you meet there, you know, they ask you questions that are so direct that wouldn't be asked in a sort of more formal bookish environment. So you get to hear what people who are reading really think. That's not covered in any kind of PC-ness, and I enjoy those conversations.
I think it's quite dismaying all over the world at the moment. The first public utilities that are getting their budgets cut are always the libraries. And yeah. In South Africa, it seems as though the local councils took the gap with COVID. They had to close the libraries, and then they just never opened them again. I was recently in the city formerly known as Port Elizabeth, and the main library is closed. The Joburg Main Library is closed. Is the Cape Town Library open?
It is open. I think what they're doing now, or what I've seen in many of the libraries, is that it's less of a sort of quiet space and more of a community center. So they're trying to do after-school programs with the kids. I know there's one library, I think it could have been Marmara or Darling, where they had an initiative where if you took a certain number of books out, you would be allowed to game on a console that was in the library for half an hour kind of thing. So, you know, I think the librarians have become very creative about making themselves part of the community. But it is very sad. I think they're underfunded and struggling. So, you know, whatever you can do to support them, I think it's good for the community.
I agree. I think libraries are a necessity, not a luxury.
I agree.
Let's talk about Valentine's Day quickly, because that is the sort of center that the Being series is built around. Every one of the books starts on or very near Valentine's Day. Why that day? What are your personal feelings about it? And how do you think women in general feel about Valentine's Day?
Well, I wanted to start around Valentine's Day because of all the hype around Valentine's Day and the expectation that it's going to be this perfect day. I mean, the way that it's been sold and marketed with all the teddy bears and the flowers and the chocolates and all of that kind of thing. So I like to think that my books are a bit of satire in a way. It makes fun of the things that you expect to happen. And so I like to start around that because it's sort of the expectation that it's going to be this really romantic, soft and fluffy kind of book, and then to have a disaster happen on or around that day. So I like that sort of contrast. As for me and Valentine's Day, I'm not a religious person, So I like to celebrate all the other stuff. I like Valentine's Day. I like Easter. I like Halloween. I like all of the stuff that is commercial and that the party packs are ready in the shops. You know, I don't have to think about the. So I like that kind of thing. So, you know, it depends. My boys get tired of getting Valentine's Day chocolates, but that's what happens here. But they also get Easter eggs and, you know, so all of the stuff that's very commercial, I do unfortunately go for. But, you know, somebody's got to be a consumer.
Very important role.
Keep the economy going.
Carnita, you're doing good work there. Well done on keeping the economy going. And I had a brilliant question that's gone straight out of my head. Oh, you are making us laugh so much speaking to you, and your books are also filled with your humor. You know, you deal with serious issues, but like we've said, it is in a light way, and a lot of that is to do with humor. Talk to us about writing humor and if that's changed at all for you as people have become more woke, more PC, and writing humor has become a more delicate balancing act.
I don't know how to specifically write humor. I don't think that now I'm going to write a funny scene. I don't actually know how that works. I don't know the nuts and bolts of it. But I know what I find funny. And that's what I tend to write. So if I see something that strikes me as funny, that probably live in my head and come out somewhere in some kind of form in a book. So I don't actually know how you write humor. What was the other part of the question? You're not the only one that... Oh, the wokeness of it, the awareness of it. I think I am naturally an overthinker. And so I am probably quite cautious without realizing that I am. So, and I'm also not somebody that seeks out conflict, and I use humor to sort of diffuse situations in that kind of way. So it's not something that I have to edit myself about. I think that's just the way that it comes out. I'm probably sharper in when I speak to somebody because it's not written down for somebody to read for the rest of their lives. So, yeah, it's sort of a roundabout answer of saying I don't know anything.
Well, Carnita, we are so excited to hear that you have handed in a novel project, which makes me think it's going to be coming our way quite soon. We are super looking forward to that.
Cross your fingers. Yeah. Nothing's a certainty.
Fingers are very firmly crossed. We can't wait. We are very hopeful. But in the meantime, we want to finish off the way we always finish off, which is by asking you, what have you been consuming lately? What have you been reading or listening to or watching that has made any kind of impression on you?
This is also a question that I agonized over because I always listen to what other people recommend. And some people have got such literary works that I can't hardly think I'm going to pick them up off the shelf and walk anywhere else. But I've been on quite a good reading stint, so I can say that I have read stuff, but I have to keep lists. As you can see, I'm also looking because I never remember. The one that I've got that I enjoyed the most recently is called The List by Yomi Adegoke. I'm not sure how you pronounce it. It's a book set in the UK, and it's essentially about a very, she labels herself as a very feminist writer, not the author, I mean the character. Mm-hmm. And her fiancé appears on a list of abusers that gets publicized on Twitter, and it's only there for a day or two. And her sort of normal modus would have been to completely just cancel this guy. But because it's her fiancé and they're due to get married in a month, she can't do that. So it's the process that she goes through during that month. But the power of the book is that it's written in such an easy to read, very light way. But the issues that it deals with are completely serious. It's about the power of social media. It's about the wokeness of the world. It's about the pressure that influencers feel. How you show up in your media presence versus how you are in your real life. So very, very real issues, but written in such a light way. It's got a purple cover with an emoji on it. And you think, how much of a book is this going to be kind of thing. but it's really very good. And there, wait, I wrote down other stuff here because I also wanted to sound impressive like your other people on your podcast. I read Angela McCaw's new book, The Read Dance Talker. I like that a lot.
Oh, I haven't read it yet.
It's very good. And then I read, which I think is a literary book, but you know, I can't be sure, but it was quite impressive to me because it was in French and now it's translated to English and it won an award. And it's called My Husband by Maud Ventura. And I really hated this character for probably for 3/4 of this book because she is obsessively in love with her husband. Mm-hmm. Like they've been married for years and her entire way of being is molded to what she thinks this man is going to, how he's going to react to her, from her hair color to what she has for breakfast, to everything is completely obsessively in love with her husband. And I thought, how weird. Like after such a long time, how weird would that be? And then there comes a twist in the end, which I didn't see coming. And it made me love the book after I hated it for most of it. So it was an interesting exercise in how you can really not like the main character for so long, and then just one thing changes and you're completely back into it. So,
and I'm now going to have to read it to find out what that twist is. You've sold me on that one. You've sold me on both of them.
Books. I fancy all of them. They're going on my to be read pile.
Yay! I can't wait for the newsletter now.
Carnita, thank you so much for your time. We hope everyone checks out the Being series, which is still in bookshops. It's still in print and also available electronically, which is where I've read the whole series. We can't wait for your next project. Thank you so much for your time. It's been a pleasure.
And I'm just going to say, if you have a holiday coming up at all and you are looking for something that you can, a world you can sink yourself into, the Being books are just, they're fabulous. If you haven't read them, you have to. Just go and read them.
Absolutely.
Thank you, Carnita.
Thank you. Such a pleasure.
Gail, I think you will agree with me when I say that Carnita did not disappoint.
She really didn't. You know, it's always difficult for me when we speak to someone that I have a real friendship with. And Carnita, honestly, is one of my favorite people in the world. So I look forward to it because I'm always happy to see her. But also, it's a bit weird interviewing a good friend.
Right.
But that was just, I learned so much from her. And it was extraordinary. She is extraordinary.
She really is. And I think we both learned the same thing and we want to talk about the same thing. And it can be summed up in one word, which is calendar. What did you make of that?
How amazing is that? I think I'm speaking for a lot of writers when I say it's one of the big challenges of writing. You just start writing and you don't know what your timeline is and you don't know what season it is and you don't know how much time is going to pass in your story. And suddenly you've got your days wrong. With the Katie Gales, we can plan it as carefully as we want to. We will get the days wrong.
Mm-hmm.
It's a real challenge of writing. And then Carnita starts there. How did you feel about it?
To be honest, I can't wait to try it. I want to get home. I want to flip open a calendar and I want to start planning a book around that. Or even take a book that I'm only about 5,000 words in and look at it from a calendar point of view. And I think I need to pin myself down to a year as well and try to work out, is this going to be over weeks or months? Which months? Which chapters are going to cover which months? It's important. And I think that when we start getting editors on this podcast, which we are planning to do, they will tell us that it's a universal weakness among writers.
Absolutely. I mean, I must say the book I'm working on now, there's a part that's set in 2008. And for the first time in my life, I printed out a 2008 calendar so I can know what day things fall on.
Right.
Because it's important to the plot. So maybe I am more ready for calendars than I realize. But this idea of thinking in books and timelines is revolutionary for me.
Yeah. No, I have to try it. And my advice for the week is advice for me and for our listeners, which is whip out a calendar and see if you can plot a short story or a novel around that and see where that takes your writing, because I can't wait to do it.
Absolutely. I want to just speak quickly about another thing about Carnita that made a huge impression on me, which is the joy that she approaches her work with, that she, mm-hmm. you know, writing is a joy for her. Mm-hmm. Her books are about joy. She centers the whole experience on joy. And I found that very inspiring because I do think we are desperate for joy in the world at the moment. And so that excited me a lot. So I just wanted to mention it and highlight it. And maybe my advice for the week starts there, that writing should be joyful. Mm-hmm. And if it's not joyful for you, unless you feel like you're doing a very important social task, and some writing is about that, and that's important too. Mm-hmm. But if your writing's not bringing you joy, what really are you doing writing at all? It should in some level bring you joy, even if you're writing about quite serious things. And if it's not, maybe you need to re-examine what you're writing and why you're writing.
Yeah. And if you are writing something very serious, do you at least get joy from the sense of purpose that it's giving you? Do you feel that you're doing important work and that gives you a kind of satisfaction?
Absolutely. The joy must be somewhere, even if the book is not a joyful book. Absolutely.
And Carnita's books really are joyful. Her attitude of joy leaks into the prose.
Absolutely.
And I've never had anything but a wonderful time reading Absolutely. Her books. So we hope everybody checks out Carnita's Being series, which is available widely and everywhere. And I think is often featured in specials in bookstores. I've seen the whole Being series available for a discount price lately. So go and check that out if you have not already been introduced to her. And if you are going to try this calendar method that we've stumbled upon, or if you have tried it and it's worked for you, please get in touch. We're on all social media. We're on email. You can contact us in a number of ways, and we would love to hear from you.
You've been listening to another production from Solid Gold Podcasts.